I was 16 years old and my father allowed me to go.
I was just turned 17 at the time.
I was 16.
And I was 15 years.
When they came to us, they were frightened children and had to be made into soldiers.
Those are just some of the voices featured in last year's World War I documentary, They Shall Not Grow Old. This being a film from Peter Jackson, the wizard who won 3 Oscars, including Best Picture, for his final Lord of the Rings movie, They Shall Not Grow Old is a technological marvel. In the midst of awards season, the film is returning to theaters for 3 nights in December. For They Shall Not Grow Old, Jackson took original archival footage of the daily life of British troops from 1914 through 1918, and he restored it to a point where it feels absolutely modern. He also colorized the film, bringing the soldiers to life. The film's narration comes mostly from interviews with World War I veterans recorded by the BBC about 40 years after the war ended. Jackson has built up quite a film empire in his native New Zealand, but last year we sat down with him in Beverly Hills. How did this get started? I'm not clear. I know that it's a thing, but I don't know where you came into it.
Well, I didn't know I was going to do it, but I was in the UK. I'm pretty sure it was for the premiere of the last Hobbit film, and the Imperial War Museum asked me to come in for a meeting to talk to them. And what they were doing then, this was 2013, I think, they were preparing their schedule for the 100th anniversary of the First World War from 2014 to 2018, and they were commissioning a lot of different arts projects with, you know, seem to be dozens and dozens of them, all sorts of different things, as part of their whole 4-year program. And they wanted to talk to me about a documentary that they were going to do for the end of the First World War. So this was 2018. So it was 5 years into the future. It seemed like a long way into the future. And they just said to me, would I be interested in being involved in it? And, you know, cause, and I said, yeah. I said, what do you have in mind? They said, we don't have anything in mind, just a documentary. But, however, the only proviso is that we want it to just be made from our original First World War archive footage. No new filming, no recreations, no reenactment. It has to be 100% original First World War footage, of which they have an extensive archive, one of the biggest in the world, of that particular war. And I said, okay. And they said, we really want to find somebody who can make a documentary, who can use our original footage in a fresh and original way. I think fresh and original, okay, right. I haven't got a clue. And all I was doing in my mind was playing every bloody documentary that I've ever seen in my life, decades and decades worth of First World War documentaries, because I do watch them in the same
footage. Did you sort of say, I'm not actually British?
Well, no, because the British Empire was involved in this war, and we still consider ourselves
British enough
empire,
for these purposes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and it was very much, you know, obviously centered on the British story, because that was all, I was only allowed access to their archive, not to anyone else's. And so I said, well, give me a chance to have a think about it. And you know, I really didn't have a clue what it could be. And so I went back to New Zealand, and then I started to just think about, well, film footage in a fresh and original way, I wonder how well we can restore it. Because,
right.
I mean, people have been restoring films, obviously, for years. But I couldn't think of a time or an example where someone had taken sort of, you know, 100-year-old footage and put all the computer firepower that we have today to the single purpose of trying to make this footage look brand new, like it was shot now. So I was curious, and I didn't know what the result would be, because I obviously have never done it, but I was a question. I thought, well, I wonder how good we can make it look. So then I asked them to send me 2 or 3 minutes. So they scanned something and they sent us a file over the net. And I said, just give me a few weeks and I'll just have a play with it. I just want to try some stuff out. And so I got our team in New Zealand at Park Road Post to then put their heads into how we could restore this stuff.
Let me just say, Park Road Post is obviously this beautiful facility you have in Wellington, which I've luckily visited, you do this amazing work.
Yeah. We've got a little CGI department that's
a little
because,
one.
Because, well, it's not Weta Digital. Weta Digital,
right,
which is
I've
just down the road,
too, and
it's got thousands
of
people.
Other thing, yeah.
Park Road Post has got like 30 or 40 people in it who do CGI work now.
The other places where the avatar is and that sort of thing.
Yes,
is done.
Yeah. And so what we came to realize is that you've got to just look at it. It's not actually kind of hard in the sense of you just got to watch it and start to list all the problems with it. And they're the problems that we all know from this old footage. I mean, it's the scratches often what the Imperial War Museum have got is they've got a duplicate of a duplicate of a duplicate. A lot of it's third
but
or
people
fourth.
Are also hand cranking the film. Yeah, the speed's variable.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And I've grown up my entire life being led to believe from all the books I read that silent movies, you know, with a hand cranked were 16 frames a second. And I just rediscovered very quickly that it ain't true at all. Mm-mm. Because in order to put the speed
right... How could
you
be that consistent as a human?
No, and how can you be consistent if you're under shell fire?
Right,
I'm sure your heartbeat and the adrenaline is going to dictate a little bit of how you're turning the handle of the camera. So, you know, but of course, if you just think about it for a moment, to actually end up at 24 frames a second, which is, you know, we need to get it to today's speed, you can't do that unless you know what the original speed was, because you have to, basically, the computer is like, you tell the computer, this was shot at 13 frames, we want it at 24 frames. Please. You say please.
The computer likes you being polite. Right.
You keep doing it till you just nail it. And you know when you nail it, God, if one frame a second, too fast, too slow, you notice it. When it clicks into exactly the speed, everything comes to life and everything feels real and natural. And it's quite. But, of course, what happens too is that I didn't want to make it a step printing kind of thing. So let's just say if it's shot at 12 frames a second, it's the easiest thing to think of. Then one way to do it is be to print every frame twice to get to 24. But that gives you a kind of a jerkiness because you're looking at two frames, then two frames, then two frames, and it doesn't really. I wanted it all to be smooth, and so with the software that we have now, the computer will create the missing frame. So say you've got like 14 frames a second originally shot, you want to go to 24, you've got 10 frames that don't actually exist, and the computer figures out a way to create those 10 frames, puts them in, and yet the whole thing kind of feels smooth. You don't feel where those extra frames are. And it takes the frames before and after. It blends them together. It creates sort of a new picture from, you know, the original material. It's
unbelievable. Your eye reads it as this very smooth experience.
I mean, I don't even know how it does it.
Well, if you don't know, I guarantee you I don't.
No, fortunately, I just get to say, you know, just to ask them to happen and it happens. But anyway, you realize that a lot of what you're doing when you talk about restoring this stuff is really you're actually just correcting the damage. Image of 100 years is sort of what you're
doing. I
always
thought it looked like that then, though. It did, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. Well, I mean, if one of those cameramen shooting and you got it developed and looked at it the next day, it would look sharp and beautiful and clean. Obviously, the speed would be whatever the speed was, but this film shrinks, the sprocket holes warp and distort, so it jiggles around in the printers or the projector. It's just a lot of it is correcting the damage of 100 years is what you really, to go back to something approaching what the original negative would have been like. And then in the Imperial War Museum, I don't want to claim credit for finding it because it's been sitting in the catalogue for decades, but they've got 42 reels, and a reel meaning 6 to 8 minutes, 42 reels of outtakes. They said, we don't know what this stuff is. No one's ever really gone through it. It's all a mixture of all over the place. And I thought, yep, outtakes is fantastic. That's exactly, I want the outtakes. And so we got these 42 reels, which is hours and hours and hours of footage. And it was incredible stuff in there. This stuff had never been seen before.
You just wanted the kind of day-to-day of life.
And a lot of it is the camera original. Because it's outtakes.
Oh, right. It didn't
original
go through
camera
all the torture.
Camera,
yeah.
I mean, it's beautiful, beautiful, pristine quality. That stuff that hasn't been damaged. And nor has it really ever been seen before. So we got a lot of great material from these outtakes.
Was it an expensive process? And did the War Museum say, yes, we can do that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the film wasn't very expensive. It was the cheapest movie I've made for a long time since Heavenly Creatures. But no, I mean, I was just lucky because I had all the resources of the museum, so we could phone up and say, can you send us another 25 hours, please? And I just said to them, look, I can't even figure out what this film's about, because they said, have you got any, you know, once we did the test to restore it and we could see how amazing it could look, they were really wanting me to tell them what film I was making. I said, well, I can't, because I've got to see the material. I didn't shoot any of the stuff. I don't know what is there. And I didn't want to have a preconceived notion where I'm got some vision in my head and I sort of try to, you know, make everything fit. I said, I've got to see as much as you can possibly give me. So they sent over 100 hours. I said, look, the deal that I'll do is we'll restore it for free. Every bit of film that you send, we will restore it as a black and white. And so at least your archive will end up with having this, you know, a restored. So they were sending me lots and lots of film, which was fantastic. The more I could see, the better. And then we were looking at it, restoring it. Now I was talking 2 years is going by. You know, this is like a 5-year project, so we're into year two or year three. And one of the things with the restoration is the humanity of the men jumps off the screen. You know, they're suddenly real people again. So then I thought, well, okay, if that's the case, I mean, I was just, this was me making it up as well. As
right,
went along.
You're in the wheels were turning.
I thought if that's the case, then with the only voices we should hear are their voices.
Right.
So I then went to the Imperial War Museum and the BBC, and I said, can you send me all the audio interviews that you did with veterans of the war, but I only want them the ones that you did in the 1960s and 70s, because they did a lot of audio interviews in the 80s and 90s when these guys were like you know, you're almost 100 years old. And I didn't want the voices of
100
years
old. Right, you wanted it to sound more vital.
I wanted some people mm-hmm. a little bit more vibrant and more sort of, you know, sparky.
So that you could imagine they were speaking.
Yeah.
As younger men.
Well, they weren't much older than me, so very young men, yes. than I am now. They were in their 60s and 70s. So, BBC had done a series called The Great War in 1963, and they had interviewed hundreds and hundreds of veterans, of which only a tiny little fraction of it's in the show that they made. So I said, can you give me all those tapes? And they actually didn't quite know where they all were. But over the course of a year or two, they found more and more of them, in cupboards and shelves, and they kept sending me more and more which was great, because they're now very pleased because they've gone through and made sense of all these hundreds of rolls of tape that they had been sitting there and unused.
Coming up after a short break, fans of Jackson's early low-budget films Bad Taste and Meet the Feebles have a treat in store. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're revisiting our conversation with Sir Peter Jackson. His World War I documentary from last year, They Shall Not Grow Old, is returning to select theaters for 3 nights this December. Made up of restored footage, They Shall Not Grow Old is a vivid look at the experience of British soldiers during the Great War, from the patriotism that inspired many to enlist to the grim realities of trench warfare.
We were in conditions that isolated us completely from civilization. We got so degenerate, so isolated, living in this mud.
And you could sympathise with how a rabbit must feel, because we were hunted by mankind just the same as a rabbit.
You knew your lives were in one another's hands, and it united you very closely, and you didn't let anything interfere with that.
In addition to very precise restoration work, Jackson also carefully added colour to much of the black and white footage. Was colorization in your mind early?
Colorization was literally coming together as I went along. There wasn't anything in my mind at the beginning. It was just a slight panic was the only thing in my mind. But once we restored it to a pristine black and white level, it became clear that, these guys are coming to life. We've got all this amazing audio interview material when these guys are reasonably young. And so we've got to colorize it. Colorizing is a very controversial thing in the film industry, but it's controversial in the sense of, taking a movie the director has chosen to shoot in black and white, a DP has carefully lit it for black and white, and then somebody comes along and smudges color all over it. And, that's obviously not a good thing. But these cameramen were government employees. They were sent by the British government to the Western Front to record the war for posterity. I mean, it's the first time in history that movie film existed in the British government. Fortunately, they had the idea of we should be filming this because one day it will be historical, And they were also using it for propaganda purposes at times too. So, and I just thought, well, I don't have an issue with colorization because I'm sure if any one of those government cameramen was packing their bags for the Western Front and somebody walks in and says, now you can take either the black and white film stock or you can take the color film stock, which would you like? They would have grabbed the color straight away, but they couldn't because
it
didn't exist. So I just thought, well, let's make it look like it did for the guys that were there. But then the soundtrack had to be done because people don't realize that even a modern film like, a Tolkien film you're largely dealing with a silent movie. The actor's dialogue you've got, but if you're doing a dragon on screen and gold coins falling over the place, you don't have any sound for that. You just have to make noises. So we've got a great sound team that are so fussy and they look at every tiny thing and they make sure it's... So I just gave it to them and said, please just make this sound like there was a recordist right there on the day next to the cameraman. I just want it to sound real. And, of course, that stretches into the people talking on screen because their lips are moving and we don't know what they're saying. They've got a clue. But fortunately, there's people, I had no idea that these people exist, but they're wonderful, clever people. There's forensic lip readers. And I believe they do work mainly for law enforcement, like security camera footage if there's a bank raid or something and they see these guys talking, they want to figure out what they're saying in case there's some clues to solve the crime. So we sent all the shots that we had of people talking to these forensic lip readers. I'm sure they'd never experienced anything quite like this in their lives. Obviously, we'd restored it at this point, so we had the speed of the, it was 24 frames and sharp, and that was very helpful to them. And they would come back and say, well, this is what this guy's saying. And you look at it and think, oh, are they really saying that? I mean, okay, good. And then we would look at the regiment, because the British Army came from all over the UK and their accents go all over the bloody place. And their accent dictates quite a lot of how speed that they talk and the rhythm and the vowels and the consonants and all this. So we, if the regiment was from Yorkshire, we'd go and get an actor from Yorkshire. If it was from Kent, we'd go and get someone from Kent. And we'd say, look, this is what they're saying. Can you record this? And we put the two together, and every time it fitted.
Boys, here it comes. We're in the pictures.
and I'm sure if it was wrong, if the lip readers had got it wrong, you'd know. But they just nailed it every single time. And so, in a way, we gave these guys voices after 100 years with modern actors. But it's the only place in the movie where we cheated,
them more real. Yeah. But it's not a device for no reason. It's a device for a very important reason.
Yeah, I just,
it's kind of remarkable. You know. They found you are one of the few people in the world, I think, who has the resources. Well, they didn't know what they wanted. You didn't know what you would do, but you have the resources to make this kind of thing.
And a lifelong interest in the First World War as well.
That too. I didn't even know
I'm not a historian by any stretch, but I know this topic very, very, very well.
So it came together kind of brilliantly. I understand that you are now wanting to apply this technique to your earlier films.
Well, people have been talking to me about when I'm going to re-release, you know, my old films. And I've got the rights to most of them. No, they're for Bad Taste and Meet the Feebles, Brain Dead, Heavenly Creatures, those four.
What are they called? They're called they have a name.
The horror ones or
the horror.
Splatstick.
Splatstick? Okay.
Yeah, like a splatter and slapstick.
And you were really going for it in these films, right?
Yeah, but I was shooting them in 16 mil. And
I mean, I read that when you were shooting, what was the first one? Was it the
bad
puppet
taste,
one?
Bad, or the, no, bad bad, taste.
You
the
were actually
the
keeping
one.
The print under your bed? You were like
no, it's kind of worse than that. I was keeping the negative under my bed.
The negative under your
I
bed,
shot,
I'm sorry.
I shot it over 4 years. You know, I was working in a newspaper every weekend.
You were like a photo engraver.
Yeah. And then when we finally got the film finished, what you do then is you've got to go and get the negative and you've got to cut the negative to match. And so I pulled this negative out from under my bed and it was moldy. It had got splotches and stains all over it. Anyway, I've never done that. I didn't keep the Lord of the Rings snake under my bed. I can assure
think
you.
Not, no.
It's, but so people have been saying to me, and we put, you know, these films came out in the 1980s and early 90s. So everyone said, well, you're going to re-release it on Blu-ray. And I said, yeah. But to be honest, I haven't had the time because I want to do a nice job. But also, I did actually a test about 5 years ago on a bit of Bad Taste and it looked pretty crappy even just then. But now we've got this. World War One has enabled us. We've written all the software and codes for restoring it. And I did a test just recently on some Bad Taste footage and it looked fantastic. So I've decided now, you know, now I'm going to try and do it in the next 12 months. It's, you know, it'll take a while because I want to supervise it very closely. And I'm going to apply my World War One restoration techniques to my old 16mm films. The time has come.
So are you thinking of doing this for other archives? I mean, people must be approaching you for all kinds of stuff.
Just beginning, but to answer your question, you know, I would love archives all around the world to sit up and pay attention to this and start restoring it. It doesn't have to be us doing the work. Because it's just digital. It doesn't cost a huge amount of money. I mean, once you figure it out, it's a pipeline. But there's so much historical footage, you know, that if you imagine all the stuff from the 1910s and 20s and 30s that is so important, historical film, and we look at it and it's shaky and people just aren't really interested. But you could make this, again, you could bring the humanity back into these films. I am we're talking to someone, which is actually a really exciting project that looks like it's going to happen, is that there's a civil rights museum and they've approached us about giving us civil rights film and doing this. So that's a project that we're going to be doing in the new year.
Okay, final question, I swear. Last time we met,
yes.
you were shooting The Hobbit. You had almost quit The Hobbit, but then you couldn't quit The Hobbit.
Right, no.
So where are we with vis-a-vis the Amazon project? Are you going to do it?
Well, I can't do it in the sense of, you know, they require like a showrunner writing lots of scripts and things. And I spoke to them a year or so ago and, you know, we were right in the middle of doing Mortal Engines in this film. And you just realize you can't. I mean, I don't have a lifestyle that lets me, unfortunately, you know, work on writing 10 scripts or...
Right.
But, so I said to them, look, you know, I'd love to help you in any way I can, but you're just going to have to go and get scripts written and, you know, and then let's have a look and see what I can do to help. And I mean, I haven't heard that they've got their scripts done yet, but I'm very happy to look at them and see if there's any way that I can do something to help them. I mean, it's also part of me that would just love to sit down and watch a Tolkien thing without having been involved in it, because I get to enjoy it.
Maybe,
but at the same time, but I don't want to be, you know, they are very nice people, and I want to, if there's anything I can possibly do to help them, I'm very open to it. But I think they're busy off with their heads buried with showrunners and scriptwriters just working on it now. So
I'm sure they would want your blessing. I could talk to you about a lot of things, Peter Jackson, but the time has come.
Next time I'm in the States.
Next time you're in the States, I'll hold you to it. Peter Jackson is the director of many films. His newest one is They Shall Not Grow Old. Thank you for joining us.
It's been great, Kim. Thank you.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business, as well as other great KCRW podcasts, at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.